left, I wish you the best, and I wish all of Israel the best. Shalom on Israel. Shalom lechol am Yisrael. Shalom lechol am Yisrael. Shalom. Shalom. Shalom.
Okay. All right. Shalom and happy Shavuos to those who are observing, and get ready. Get ready now. Chris is not in the house. We have someone else coming to now watch this. I think it is. Watch this. Okay. So we'll see you next week. Don't be late. All right, Chris is in the house. Get ready.
They're getting closer.
Oh, yeah? Watch this.
Watch what?
And now, before the next show starts, let's enjoy an intermission. You'll find our snack bar chock full of good things to eat and drink. Tasty, tempting hot dogs, thirst-quenching soft drinks, fresh, crunchy popcorn, a complete assortment of delicious candy, and a full line of cigarettes. You've plenty of time, so visit the snack bar now. A tasty treat will double your enjoyment of the show. For your convenience, we shall keep you informed of the remaining intermission time, 3 minutes before the next show starts. The next show will start in 2 minutes.
Just a minute, folks. Yes, that's all it takes to visit our refreshment counter in the lobby. There you'll find popcorn and an assortment of popular candy bars to please every taste. Try one of these delicious candy bars. Big Time, Butternut, Milkshake, Payday. Topped with Hollywood's super rich coating of the kind you like best. They taste wonderful, they're delicious, they're nutritious. Get one at our confection counter in the lobby now.
The next show will start in 1 minute.
You're listening to a new radio program called Watch This on 91.5 FM WMFO in Medford, Massachusetts. My name's Chris Earle. Thank you for listening, and thank you, of course, for watching. After 10 years of doing my music show, Time Travel, I was thinking about what to do next. So I retired the show, and earlier this year, I looked over at my Blu-rays, my DVDs, my videotapes. I had a revelation that since I have just as many movies as I do music, that I'd do a new show and do it with a rotating panel of friends and family. So over the next 2 hours, we'll be discussing movies and playing movie soundtracks. And my guest here today is Mr. Derek Gary. We will start with his five flicks. Welcome to Watch This here on WMFO Medford.
Somewhere in space, this may all be happening right now. 20th Century Fox and George Lucas, the man who brought you American Graffiti, now bring you an adventure unlike anything on your planet. Star Wars.
Here they come. Coming in too fast!
The story of a boy, a girl, and a universe. It's a big, sprawling space saga of rebellion and romance. It's a spectacle, light years ahead of its time.
I am C-3PO, human-cyborg relations, and this is my counterpart, R2-D2.
Hello.
It's an epic of heroes. Villains and aliens from a thousand worlds. Billion years in the making, and it's coming to your galaxy this summer.
Hello, sir.
WMFO in Medford, Massachusetts. My name's Chris Earle. It's Watch This, here with you until 7 p.m. My guest today, WMFO host of The Big Picture, and also my friend in arms for a number of years in comedy and Boston comedy, and huge movie fan. Most importantly, we're both huge, huge movie fans, so this is actually something new, I think, for us, talking about movies on the air.
On the air, yes.
Yeah, other than the Oscar stuff, we never really get a chance to talk about, like, past movies and our favorite movies on the air, so Mr. Derek Gary is here with me today.
Hello, hello. Well, be here until 9 o'clock tonight doing this, and then The Big Picture coming up immediately after this, so.
Big Picture, 7 to 9 every Wednesday.
Now, this, I gotta point out here, this is a dangerous question that you're asking on this show.
Yes.
Because the premise of the show is you ask people to name their five favorite movies.
Yes, or five movies that they love and not necessarily completely love. They could be something that just they want to talk about.
Now, you and I have both been involved in the film industry. We've both been in movies.
Yes.
We've both been behind the scenes in movies. I was in the media side on the local movie scene for a while.
Yes.
You know that this is a loaded question.
Mm-hmm.
Because whenever you meet somebody in the industry, what's the question that they ask? What are your three favorite movies?
Favorite movie, sure.
And that's how they more or less size up who you are.
And get a gauge, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And my top three have not changed since I was about 15 years old. So
Are they three out of the five that are on the list?
They are three out of the five on here. You've got them not in my exact order, but they're all in here.
Yeah, we did the chronological today. So we have Star Wars right in the background, of course, John Williams' score of Star Wars 1977. And we have four other movies that we picked today, and they're all in between 1977 and 1982. And if you've gotten a sneak peek of what they are, good. Otherwise, we will reveal them as we go.
Indeed.
So, basically, everybody knows Star Wars. There's so many people. Let me ask you this, because we hear this a lot now. And Star Wars, of course, to me, I love The Empire Strikes Back. I love Star Wars, because Star Wars is the original. There's so many people that go out of their way to tell you that they haven't seen Star Wars. Isn't that true?
It's a true story.
Yeah.
Back in my single days, and this is around the year 2001, 2002, somewhere in there, I broke up with a girl because she hadn't seen Star Wars.
There you go.
She hadn't seen any of them. And she was my age, so she's around 30 years old.
Yeah.
And the thing that struck me about it was, if you are around my age, Chris's age, and you haven't seen Star Wars, you've gone out of your way to do that.
But also,
that's a choice.
I think you're lying. Also, I think you're lying, because at some point you have seen at least pieces of Star Wars. You can't avoid Star Wars for over 40 years.
It's,
you can't.
It's in the culture.
Yeah.
It's everywhere in the culture.
Yeah.
And I can see, you know, oh, I've never really... I can see saying I've never sat down to watch one or I've never been interested in that. But the people who are like, yeah, I've never seen that, you're deliberately being contrarian.
Yes, exactly.
If you're doing that.
Exactly.
And it's like, you know what? Take a couple of hours out of your life and at least watch A New Hope.
Yeah.
You don't have to watch the whole thing. I know it's become this thing now.
You can't poo-poo it until you've seen it. You can't review something unless you've seen it.
It's become this thing now that's impenetrable to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Because there's 40 years of fandom caught up in it now.
Yeah.
But you can still sit down and see the first movie and at least say, oh, okay, I know what this is.
That's the next question I had for you. What's the best way to introduce yourself into Star Wars without forming an opinion? Pretty much most people our age are going to have an opinion either way at this point. But the way to do it is to watch Star Wars from 1977, which is a.k.a. A New Hope. It was called A New Hope from the beginning. It wasn't in the crawl until later.
Right.
George Lucas tweaked these things over the years, which is another story altogether. But there's another piece in here. So it's been 41 years of Star Wars history. As a matter of fact, Solo opens up on the 41st year of Star Wars, opening up on May 25th.
Yeah.
And when it gets into these generational things here, there was a point where Star Wars was considered cool and Star Trek was considered kind of uncool. And I think that was another generational gap of about 10 or 15 years with our group at the time, maybe.
It was... Well, to answer your first question, I am the proud owner of a niece and a nephew. Who my nephew is now 5 years old.
Oh, nice.
So he's now at the age where he can see these movies.
Right.
And his mom and dad were like, what, we want to expose him to this. What do we do? And I'm like, start with Star Wars.
Exactly.
Start with the film from 1977 and work through that trilogy. And then if you want to torment the kids, show them the original trilogy.
Uh-huh.
But
well, here's the other important thing, too, which is in 1977, I saw this movie on Thanksgiving weekend in 77. So it had already been out for 6 months. I was 6.5 years old. Absolutely loved it. As a matter of fact, it was sold out Thanksgiving weekend. So this is 6 months after the movie has been out. And I remember having to wait an extra show. I went with my grandfather, my uncle, my cousins, and my brothers. And we had to actually wait an extra show on Thanksgiving weekend for a movie that had been out for 6 months because it was sold out. And that was Star Wars.
I saw it at the old two screen in Saugus, Massachusetts, where the Square One Mall now stands.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in a complete lather, you know, near rabid from all the commercials that I'd seen.
Right.
And when I finally found out that I was going to get to go see it, I was losing my mind and couldn't think about anything else. But I saw the movie and I was like, oh my God, that's the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, and here's another piece. What's the next thing you did after seeing the movie back in 1977? Think about what the next thing you did as a 6-7-year-old boy. What did you want to do?
You went to Caldor and you bought the early bird kit.
That is right.
That's what you did. I got the early bird kit for Christmas.
Yeah. Okay.
And sat there like every single day going to the mailbox. Like, where is it? Where is it?
Yeah.
Where is it? Where is it? And then when it finally showed up, I just...
What was your first figure?
Nothing. Well, I got the early bird kit.
You got the early bird, so you got the four.
So I got Darth Vader, Luke Skywalker, Chewie, and Leia.
And Leia, okay.
And shortly after that, when the stuff hit the shelves, I got the land speeder.
Yeah.
And that was all I needed. That was all I played with. That was all I was interested in. It was just Star Wars all the time.
Mine was, I didn't get the early bird kit. I got R2-D2. I got them at Toys R Us in Woburn, as a matter of fact, which is now closed.
Yep.
And my first vehicle was Darth Vader's TIE.
Oh, nice.
But then when Empire Strikes Back came out, I got the Falcon. And that was like one of the best Christmas gifts ever.
I didn't get
the... Was getting the Falcon.
The Falcon was one of the last things I got. I didn't get the Falcon until I was 15 because it was so expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But the land speeder, I adored. The way that it floated, I thought it was the coolest toy in the world.
Yeah. Plus, you can put R2-D2 in the back lying down.
Yep.
You could stick your fingers in the holes and move it along, you know, like a land speeder. It was great. I loved it. So the very simplistic version of the plot is it's about a boy, a girl, and the universe.
Yeah.
That was some of the worst marketing ever early on by 20th Century Fox and Lucasfilm.
Let me give you something here because you played a trailer, the audio from a trailer for this.
Yeah.
There is actually, I think that was... cut after the film had become a hit in Los Angeles.
It was, yeah.
So what I have is a couple of the original radio commercials for this.
Little spots.
And I'll do the 30-second one.
Sure.
And this is how the marketing began for Star Wars.
Here we go.
It's only a laser sword fight. Don't be scared. It's only the Death Star destroying another world. Relax. It's only a movie, and it's all for fun. Director George Lucas and 20th Century Fox present Star Wars. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. There is.
Now, if you were listening to the radio in the 1970s, that guy did the ads for everything.
Right.
You heard that voice like every week pushing some new movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the marketing at that point is very simply, oh, we have another movie. Just, you know, this has some special effects and some sound effects.
Right.
There's another commercial they did for it, the 60-second, which is all just snippets of sound effects from Star Wars. And it's radio friendly, but it doesn't tell you anything about the movie. It doesn't make any sense at all. And it points to the fact that they had no idea what they were dealing with when they released this movie.
Yeah.
Because by the time you get to the trailer that you played, they know.
Right.
They're like, wait a minute.
Huge hit.
This is the biggest movie of all time. Everybody's going to see this five times. It's bigger than Thanos. We've got to pump this up.
It was the Thanos of its time. By the way, I did see that. I mean, that's another story altogether, yeah. But I finally saw Infinity Gauntlet. I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. Yeah. Probably my second favorite superhero movie of all time. But Ben Burtt, of course, who did the sounds, so those early marketing things with R2-D2 in the background and Darth Vader breathing and stuff, he was pretty much one of the best parts of the marketing was, let's put these weird noises in here and get people out to see this strange movie.
And one thing I remember from the TV commercials is, because nobody really got what it was about, it was a big hit, but they were trying to pull in people who were on the fence. They did a series of commercials that featured individual characters. So there was the Luke commercial, and there was the Han Solo commercial, and there was the Chewbacca commercial, and there was the R2 and C-3PO commercial. And these were all 30-second spots.
Right.
I don't think I've ever seen them pop up as bonus features on any of the discs that have come out since.
Right.
But back in 1977, when you didn't know what any of this was, like, you'd sit there and watch TV and be like, oh boy, another Star Wars commercial. Like, who's that?
Oh,
what's
yeah.
that? Who's that? What's that?
One of the coolest things that I got here, and I pulled it out on time travel a while back, was I pulled those Empire Strikes Back promos, which was right after Star Wars and right when Empire was filming. So this is around 79.
The phone-in thing?
And you'd phone in, and there were six different ones, and somebody picked up. It was either going to be C-3PO or Darth Vader or Leia. It was great, and it was really, really cool because that was something special at the time, and that was one of those things where, you know, it was almost like those mail-aways, you know? It's like something would show up that was just kind of magical, that was just for the fans.
I seem to recall that we horrified our judges on a Thanksgiving, Thanksgiving or Christmas music battle. It was a Thanksgiving music battle playing those.
Yeah, yeah. I was playing those promos, and I think you played some of the R2 and C-3PO Christmas album when they were playing the tunes Wish You a Merry Christmas or something on that one, yeah.
Hardcore fans only.
I don't know, man. It's weird to me. To me, it's weird. If people don't, like, they go out of their way not to like Star Wars, there's something weird about that to me. It's like, it's almost like if you're around people and you're enjoying drinks and there's somebody that wants to be there that is a teetotaler and they just seem to be judging you the entire time.
Yeah. It's like, why are you at the bar?
Yeah. It's like I'm going to slur my speech.
Yeah.
You're going to judge me. Please go away.
Yeah. You cannot drink at home, sir.
Yeah.
You inevitably get that knee-jerk reaction whenever something's popular. You're going to have those people who define themselves by saying, oh, I don't like that.
Right.
Because I'm above that. And if we're talking about Kardashians or we're talking about, whatever the hip show is, or like Game of Thrones or something like that.
Sure.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think you can make an argument that you shouldn't be doing that with Game of Thrones either. If you don't like science fiction, if you don't like robots, you don't like all that stuff, that's a legitimate reason to not like Star Wars.
Sure, sure.
Okay? Yeah. There are plenty of legit reasons. But if your whole argument is, I don't like it because it's popular,
right,
and I refuse to see it because I don't want to be tainted by it,
give me a break.
Right, exactly. Or they feel they're being individualistic for some reason, or self-important.
In a lot of cases, these are the same people that will scream and yell at religious people who are like, Passion of the Christ is a horrible movie.
Sure.
Yeah, and they're like, you haven't even seen that movie. How dare you condemn it?
Yeah.
And they'll turn around and be like, oh, well, I've never seen Star Wars. Mm-hmm, like, you know what? Go stick your head in some bantha poodoo.
I also have to say, I do love Game of Thrones, but also Keeping Up with Kardashians. I have watched it.
Yeah.
All right. I don't like it, but I also know not to go out of my way to hurt the person that loves that show.
Yeah, I
because
know.
It's throwaway and it's nice and they enjoy it. Whatever. You know, I just walk in the other room and do something else.
I have no use for the Kardashian industrial complex.
It's So this is done by director George Lucas, of course, who sold the franchise for about $4.09 billion or something a
Not
few
bad.
Years ago. Pretty good for a life's work.
It's better than Kubrick ever did, and Lucas is still around to enjoy it.
Yeah. Mark Hamill, Harrison Ford, Carrie Fisher, Alec Guinness, Peter Cushing, Dave Prowse, James Earl Jones are some of the people that are in there. It's distributed by 20th Century Fox. And, of course, one of the best openings ever of a movie is the 20th Century Fox logo and that wonderful, I believe it was done in like 1953, the opening for the 20th Century Fox logo with the drums and the orchestra.
I maintain that the affection that we have for the 20th Century Fox logo has everything to do with Star Wars.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
And the fact that it ran in front of all of those movies in the same way that you put the Orion logo in front of people.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh my God. Because so many great movies of the 80s and 90s came from Orion.
Absolutely.
And if you're a genre fan, you see that and you're like, ooh, this is going to be good.
Yeah. And up until a few years ago, Miramax. You know, with the independent Miramax. Miramax started off pretty early with the good films there. 20th Century Fox distributed it again. The soundtrack was done by John Williams, and original score created by him. But, of course, he was influenced by Holst the Planets from 1920, which is amazing. If you've never heard that, it's basically Holst creates a score all about the planets, and he only performed it a number of times, but you can hear like the Imperial March in there. You can hear Leia's theme. You can hear all kinds of stuff. It's very, very close to John Williams' score for Star Wars. The budget was $11 million, and after all the re-releases and everything, it's achieved $775.4 million, which is also a nice little chunk of change.
That's not bad.
And it's got an 8.6 out of 10 on IMDb, which is one of the highest scores you can really get on there for average with so many people voting.
And I mean, if you're a fan, you can be honest that it is not a perfect movie.
Right.
By any stretch.
Right.
There are amazing things that happen throughout it.
Yeah.
There are massive leaps in logic and storytelling that take place throughout.
Yeah.
There's some questionable acting in places, including Mark Hamill in some
Absolutely.
Early scenes.
Yeah.
Carrie Fisher's great in it. Harrison Ford is great in it. The special effects are, if you go back and watch the original, still pretty seamless by today's standards.
Yeah.
Most people can only see the cleaned up versions now.
Right.
And so you don't get to see the matte lines around the ships and some of those things.
Right.
But that stuff wasn't really that noticeable back in the day.
No. Or you just forgave it.
Yeah.
It was just like, okay, there's a couple of squares around the TIE fighters as they fly through space. Doesn't bother a six-year-old kid much.
It's not like watching the old Harryhausen movies where you're like, those skeletons are stop-motion animation.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. He was fantastic, by the way, too, Harry.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, Harryhausen. So he did all Jason and the Argonauts and all those. So I wanted to find a little bit of trivia that maybe you or I didn't really know. So I did do a little bit more research on Star Wars, even digging a little bit more. I consider myself pretty much a Star Wars expert, and yourself as well. So there's a few things here. Like, Lucas originally tended for Orson Welles to voice Darth Vader, which I didn't know, but he decided on lesser-known James Earl Jones. I thought that was kind of interesting.
It's a good thing he did that, because I don't think Welles outlived those three movies.
That's correct. He died in the early 80s after he promoted The Dark Tower, the video game. I think that was one of his last jobs.
His last role was as Omnicron in Transformers, the movie.
Yes. So this film was reissued multiple times, as we talked about. Lucas incorporated many, many changes, including the modified computer-generated effects, altered dialogue, re-edited shots, remixed soundtracks, and added scenes such as the Hand Shot First campaign, where Greedo goes after Hand first, which was ridiculous. And in that first round, Greedo was like 4 feet off when he was about as far as you and I are from one another.
Yeah.
So he's shooting straight ahead, and somehow the laser goes about 4 feet above Han's head.
Well, it's those big, long Rodian fingers.
Yeah.
Makes it hard to aim.
So they clean that out. One of the things that I love is they added Jabba in Star Wars, which I loved. But the thing that I didn't love is he calls him a wonderful human being in the dialogue, because he was working with a human.
Yeah.
And it's like, why would he call Jabba the Hutt, who is a Huttese? If we want to go into nerd land, he's Huttese, he's not human, he wouldn't call him that.
If you can find it, and I believe it exists now in graphic novel form, and you've never seen it, the original Marvel Comics adaptation of Star Wars includes that scene, and includes a rendering of what Jabba was sort of meant to look like.
Who is basically called Mosep now. He's in a red shirt, almost like a combination of Walrus Man and Snaggletooth.
Yeah,
and he's a skinny guy.
He's far more humanoid. He's got legs a little bit like the singer, Sice Noodles.
Exactly.
Return of the Jedi.
Yep. George Lucas was so sure that this was going to flop, he decided to go on vacation to Hawaii with Steven Spielberg when the movie came out, and they came up with the idea for Raiders of the Lost Ark that weekend, which I thought was pretty cool. In conversation with Francis Ford Coppola, Lucas was depressed because he had just come back from a meeting on his initial pitch with Universal, and they wouldn't sell him Flash Gordon, which a lot of people don't know. He wanted to do this as Flash Gordon serials. And he said, well, I'm just going to invent my own space opera, which he did, of course.
Now, you know the other Francis Ford Coppola connection to this film, right?
It was American Graffiti, plus he also worked on The Conversation?
Well, he re-edited THX 1138 without Lucas's consent.
Yeah.
And that nearly destroyed their friendship forever.
Mm-hmm.
But the original cut of Star Wars did not have the cantina scene.
No kidding.
Because Lucas couldn't afford to shoot it.
I didn't know that.
Francis Ford Coppola put up the money.
Oh, okay, okay.
For the cantina scene.
Maybe I have heard something like this. Okay.
Yeah. Yep. So that whole sequence only exists because Coppola, and they shot it in a soundstage in like 2 days.
Which, of course, was the showstopper.
Yeah.
And to this day, and for some reason, I don't know why, but in The Last Jedi, which we can go on a diatribe about that movie and how we felt about that, and you know, we had to digest that before. And you came up with one of the best reviews I read about the show.
We'll save that for another time.
But for some reason, they decided to try to throw a casino cantina scene, and it didn't work. And I do have to say this: one of the last things here before we move on to the next one is one of the things about Solo. I have looked a little bit because they've had previews, and it looks like this is being catered toward a younger crowd. And it's getting relatively lukewarm reviews.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering how Solo is
going to
do.
We've been going to see all of the Star Wars movies on opening night.
Yes.
And we have no plans to see this one.
No.
And I will get around to seeing this one, but this isn't an opening night for me.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the most telling thing was they had the big premiere last week, and they invite in all of the influencers, you know, the YouTubers and the Instagrammers,
right,
and the other people with zero credibility that you can buy off with a chance to hang out with the stars.
Yeah.
And even their response to it was mixed.
Very lukewarm, yeah.
Which, I like Ron Howard. I like his films. I like a lot of people who are involved in this. There's something off about Emilia Clarke. I don't know what it is about her.
Yeah.
There's something about her bothers me
Khaleesi.
A little bit.
Khaleesi.
Mm-hmm. I like her in Game of Thrones, but I don't know what it is.
I like her a lot. She's a little strong,
but I just
got to see what the character's about. But
I look at this and I'm like, yeah, I'll see it, but I'm going in with really low expectations.
Yeah, I am too.
I am too.
And in the review for the Chicago Sun-Times, one of the things that Roger Ebert said about the movie, what makes Star Wars experience unique is that it happens on such an innocent and often funny level. It's usually violence that draws me so deeply into a movie, violence ranging from the psychological torment of a Bergman character to the mindless crunch of a shark's jaws. Maybe movies that scare us find us with the most direct route to our imaginations. But there's hardly any violence at all in Star Wars. And even when there is, it's presented essentially as bloodless swashbuckling. So instead, there's entertainment that's so direct and so simple that all of the complications of the modern movie seem to vaporize. So this happened in the late 70s, which was kind of a healing point for the U.S. after getting out of the Vietnam War and Nixon and everything else. So this was nice to have this popcorn throwaway movie.
That was one of the things that at the time was an issue with the studio, was they did not think a film with war in the title was going to play well in the aftermath of the Vietnam War.
Right.
What they failed to recognize was that the kids, who were going to be like a big part of the audience for this, weren't connected to any of that, didn't care.
Right.
And even people who were, you know, even the grown-ups and the college kids and the older folks who were very connected to what had happened in Vietnam, some had been there, they were going to see it. And they were having a great time because there's nothing about that movie that you can look at and be like, oh, yeah, that's the way it was in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. It's a completely, it's a war story, but when you think about it, it doesn't really feel like a war story.
Right.
It doesn't really feel like you're in the middle of this grand epic conflict. Although you blow up the Death Star at the end, there's only a few ships involved in all of this.
Right.
And it's not until later on when you get into films like Rogue One that you start to get a better sense of the scope of what's going on.
That's what was kind of cool about Rogue One, was it had a little bit more violence in there, because really you're not seeing too much in Star Wars. You see the saber fight, but Obi-Wan, spoiler alert, basically sacrifices himself.
Yeah.
And you know, the lasers, no, stormtroopers aren't even hitting anybody.
A couple of ships get blown up, a couple of stormtroopers die.
That's
and,
right.
You know,
that's pretty much it.
Everybody else goes home.
Anything else you want to say about Star Wars? Otherwise, we'll move on to the next.
No, we can move on.
We'll move on to the next flick. All right, here comes flick number two. You are listening to Watch This, here with you until 7 p.m., myself and Derek Gary. Thanks for listening to your freeform station, WMFO in Medford.
Halloween night. A small American town. 15 years ago. Michael?
I spent 8 years trying to reach him, and then another 7 trying to keep him locked up, because I realized that what was living behind that boy's eyes was purely and simply evil. I think he'll come back.
Exploring uncharted territory.
And totally charted.
Just
sure.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason she
babysits
is to have
Halloween.
Okay, Linda. Come on out.
Help! 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 Help!
Here we go. Flick number two. It's Halloween from 1978. It's an hour and 31 minutes. Of course, it's a horror movie, also a thriller. It came out October 27th of 1978 in the USA. A great year for horror movies, actually, 1978. Directed by John Carpenter, it starred Jamie Lee Curtis and the wonderful Donald Pleasance. Jamie Lee Curtis with one of the best horror screams in horror movies. The plot is, for anybody who has not seen it, 15 years after murdering his sister on Halloween night 1963, Michael Myers escapes from a mental hospital and he returns to the small town of Haddonfield to kill again. The studio was Compass International Pictures, so it was a small independent. The soundtrack was by the director, John Carpenter. It's very distinct, it's very simple, and it's very haunting. The budget was between $300,000 and $325,000, and it made in between $60 and $70 million, which is why studios love the returns on horror movies that succeed. It has an IMDb score of 7.8 out of 10, and Derek has picked this as his second of his five flicks.
This is on every Halloween night at my house.
Love it, me too.
If it's Halloween night, once the trick-or-treaters are gone, the movie is going in the Blu-ray player.
And it's still very, very frightening.
Yes.
A lot of people are like, it's not the most frightening movie. But I think a lot of people say top five list. I'm saying top two or three because there's moments in this, like in the closet, the shadow in the background when he just kind of shows up. And if you have the settings just right on your TV, it's like, whoa, where did that come from?
I've probably seen this movie 50 times by now.
Yeah.
And the thing about it is you get so that you know where the jump scares are going to be.
Yes.
But I will put the scene of Jamie Lee Curtis trying to get back into the house with Michael Myers coming from across the street as one of the most suspenseful and well-structured moments of tension in any motion picture ever made.
Yeah.
You can put it up there with
Psycho,
Jack Nicholson, and hacking down
in The Shining,
the bathroom door in The Shining.
Sure. Yep.
As one of these sort of how do you get out of this situation moments? And it's done so well.
Plus, with the soundtrack that he has in the background, which is so sparse, but also so deliberate.
Yeah.
And it's so scary. It's like, oh my God, this is the point where people yell, run, in the theater. They scream and yell, run.
Now, one of the things I like about this movie is I am as Chris knows, and as my regular listeners may know, I am a huge, huge horror movie fan.
Myself as well.
I've been a horror movie fan my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
I have a particular fondness for Italian horror.
Yes.
And at the time that Halloween was made, the Giallo films of Mario Bava and Lamberto Bava and Lucio Fulci and a young Dario Argento were all of the rage.
Right.
Those films were popping up in the grindhouse cinemas in New York and Chicago and Los Angeles. And people who were making grindhouse movies, who inevitably, you know, your Wes Cravens and your Sean Cunninghams, who inevitably went on to do Hollywood horror,
yeah,
were seeing these films. And the thing about the giallos is it's basically, if you take anything and give it to an Italian, the Italian is going to find a way to make it sexier and more stylish.
Of course,
it's
yes,
what they do.
Mm-hmm.
So the Italians took Hitchcock, and they said, oh, we can make these sequences 10 times more elaborate and mm-hmm, 10 times more visceral and 10 times more sexy. And they did all of that. So at the same time that John Carpenter is working on this, Sean Cunningham is in the woods across the country shooting what will become Friday the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
Friday the 13th is pretty much a summer camp movie crossed with a giallo by the name of Twitch of the Death Nerve.
Okay.
Which is Mario Bava.
Mm-hmm.
Twitch of the Death Nerve is a story about siblings knocking each other off to try and get an inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
And Friday the 13th took murder sequences directly from Twitch of the Death Nerve and used them in Friday the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
And that started the whole sort of giallo approach to American horror films.
Mm-hmm.
The slasher films, your Freddy and your Jason and all that, are very heavily influenced by the Italians.
Right.
John Carpenter either hasn't seen these movies or isn't interested in these movies,
mm-hmm,
because what he makes here has nothing to do with Italian cinema.
I would say this is more of a suspense movie than an actual horror movie, because there's hardly a drop of blood in the movie,
yeah,
at all. There's almost next to nothing.
But that's, to me, and this is true, the only blood that you actually see in the movie is at the very end when Jamie Lee Curtis is discovering all of her friends.
Yeah.
And then she gets cut and there's a little blood on her arm.
Yeah.
But compared to the other stuff that was coming out at the time,
yeah,
which is blood and guts all over the screen, that's giallo influence.
Yes.
Carpenter has none of that.
Yeah.
And Carpenter has none of the giallo tropes other than the sort of first person, you know, come kill with me.
Yeah.
Steadicam bit at the beginning.
Even the very first Friday the 13th is relatively tame compared to all the stuff that happened later,
right,
with Jason and, you know, Freddy Krueger and all that. It got super, but it was also, you know, you had the Italian movies. It's like some of them are just super violent.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, it, yeah, just got crazy.
But that was
the 80s.
That's,
you know,
what they do. And,
yeah,
the thing that I always loved about Halloween is in the midst of this, you know, you got zombies going and you got all this Italian influence all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
John Carpenter is making a movie that is completely his and is completely unique.
Mm-hmm.
And it stands apart from all of the other horror cinema that came before it and came in the immediate years after it.
I love John Carpenter, actually. He's got some great, great flicks. I love They Live. I love Escape from New York. One of the great stories that I saw here in Trivia Land was Mustafa Akkad, which was a producer, asked John Carpenter how much the movie could be made for, and John Carpenter said $300,000. And Mustafa Akkad at the time was producing and filming a major motion picture with Laurence Olivier, which was costing his company $300,000 a day. So when John Carpenter told him the fixed price of his movie, he immediately funded it.
Yeah.
And of course, the return was $60, $70 million.
Yeah. This was one of the highest grossing movies of all time.
Yeah.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre eclipsed it. And I believe the original Night of the Living Dead eclipsed it.
Right.
But it was in the top five for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's an exercise in suspense. And the other thing that Carpenter does really, really well in this movie is he brings Deborah Hill in to write the girls.
Right.
And Deborah Hill knows these girls, knows the way that they talk. And if you watch that movie, you can see sort of the early Valley Girl, the prototypical Valley Girl, played out across these three different characters.
Right.
You know, these are the, because they're California, like Deborah Hill and John Carpenter, they're both California kids.
Yep.
This is what you're going to see in movies like Fast Times at Ridgemont High,
right,
and Valley Girl 4 or 5 years down the road, when the California culture sort of spread out to the rest of the country.
Yeah. So also a producer, Deborah Hill there, she volunteered to be Michael because the six-year-old actor wasn't available one day. So when his hands come into view early on, you get to see well-manicured and varnished hands that actually belong to Deborah Hill, the producer.
That's something I'd never known. That is something I'd never known.
One thing, too, that a lot of people don't know, and I know you know this, they actually called him The Shape. So it wasn't Michael Myers in the first film. I think they just called him The Shape, and yep, I think he's actually credited as The Shape versus Michael Myers in the actual credits there. So one of the scenes where he appears out of darkness, they took a simple dimmer switch on a light and slowly illuminated the William Shatner Captain Kirk mask that they used. Jamie Lee Curtis, this was her first movie. She was reportedly paid $8,000 for her efforts, for carrying this whole film.
I hope she got a piece on the back end.
Yeah, no kidding. And also, I heard this week that they are remaking another Halloween with Jamie Lee Curtis, and it's supposed to take place right after this 1978 Halloween movie and totally ignore the rest of the canon.
Everything beyond 2. The yeah, new one takes 2 into account, because 2 is a direct sequel to this.
When they're at the hospital.
When they're at the hospital. Yeah. Everything after that, forget it. Mm-hmm. And John Carpenter is actually going to write some music for the new one, too.
Yeah, I heard that. It's crazy. And you have Kenny Powers in it as well.
Yeah.
Kenny Powers is going to show up in it. Other things here. Stabbing sound effect is a knife stabbing a watermelon when they actually have the stabbing sound. Jamie Lee Curtis has said she loathes horror movies, and she does not like to be surprised, which is kind of a interesting thing, because she became a scream queen after that. One other notice I found in the trivia was Dennis Quaid was almost part of the filming. PJ Souls was dating Dennis Quaid at the time, so John Carpenter and Deborah Hill actually wanted to cast him in the role of Bob, who is one of the friends, one of Laurie's friends, but unfortunately Dennis Quaid was busy working on other projects at the time. So
PJ Souls, great performance in that movie.
Yeah.
Two things about her performance I particularly enjoyed, but I don't know if I can say that in the Me Too era anymore. That's the scene that gets cut whenever it's on television.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
And if you can find it, it is absolutely worth tracking down. I had it years ago, and I finally got my hands on a copy of it again last fall.
Yes.
For the television version,
yeah,
of Halloween,
yes,
there were things they had to cut, which included a lot of the PJ Souls murder scene.
Yep.
Where she's topless. Some of the violence. And so they went in during Halloween 2 and shot additional scenes for the television version.
Right.
There is an Anchor Bay DVD that has all of that stuff put back into it.
Mm-hmm.
So you get the full version of Halloween, and then you get the additional shot for TV scenes.
Right.
And it adds a little bit of texture to Jamie Lee Curtis's character. It adds a little bit of texture to the other characters. You get a little bit more with Loomis and Michael Myers.
Yeah. I love the part when Loomis is at the university, too, and he's talking.
Yeah.
And I remember actually seeing it on television in the past, and seeing those added scenes, and just be like, wow, you were just in wonder. It was almost like when you saw Superman 2, and saw like some of the other Richard Donner stuff, and you're like, wow, this is great.
Yeah.
Because at the time, you know, you didn't have the Criterion collections of laser discs and Blu-rays and DVDs for those things. So this week, I decided to do a close-up for this, for a scene from Halloween. So, Derek, are you ready for your close-up? I picked a scene with Brackett and Dr. Loomis. Brackett is, of course, the policeman.
Yep.
And they're checking out Michael Myers' house. So would you like to be Dr. Loomis, or would you like to be the narrator in Brackett? It's up to you.
I'll take Dr. Loomis.
You're going to be Dr. Loomis?
If that's all right with you.
All right. I will be the narrator, and I will be policeman Brackett. So here we go. A police car pulls up in front of the Myers' house. Brackett and Loomis get out and stand by the front gate.
Anybody live here?
Not since 1963, since it happened. Every kid in Haddonfield thinks this place is haunted.
They may be right.
Looking down the side of the house, we see Loomis and Brackett walk up to the front porch. A broken, rusted rain gutter clangs back and forth against the house in the wind. They go inside. The front door slowly opens. Brackett and Loomis stand in the doorway and glance at one another. Brackett draws his gun, and the two men step aside. It's totally dark in the house. Brackett's flashlight comes on and illuminates the two men. As they move through the house, we track with them. Suddenly, Brackett stops, and he trains his flashlight on a small object in the corner of the room.
What is it?
For a moment, Brackett doesn't speak. Then he steps closer to the object. It's a dog. Still warm.
He got hungry.
Come on. A skunk could have killed it.
Could have.
A man wouldn't do that.
He isn't a man.
Myers' bedroom. Loomis and Brackett cautiously step into the bedroom, the same room where the murder took place 15 years ago. The glow from a distant streetlight cast the shadows of blowing trees on the walls.
It happened in here.
Loomis walks over to the spot where the sister was sitting.
She was sitting here when he came through the door.
Loomis turns and glances at the window. He slowly walks toward it.
He must have watched them through this window. Standing just outside, he could peer over the sill.
Blown loose by the wind, the rain gutter suddenly swings down and smashes through the window with a thundering crash of broken glass. Loomis jumps back, reaches into his coat pocket, and draws a .357 Magnum revolver. Brackett just stares at him. Loomis sees Brackett's reaction and slowly holsters the revolver.
I suppose I do seem a bit sinister for a doctor.
Looks like to me you're just plain scared.
I am.
He glances around the bedroom.
I met him 15 years ago. I was told there was nothing left. No conscience, no reason, no understanding, in even the most rudimentary sense of life or death or right or wrong. I met this 6-year-old boy with a blank, cold, emotionless face and the blackest of eyes, the devil's eyes. I spent 8 years trying to reach him, and another 7 trying to keep him locked away when I realized what was living behind that boy's eyes was purely, simply, evil.
What do we do?
He was here earlier tonight. And he may be coming back. I'm going to wait for him.
I keep thinking I should call the radio and TV stations.
If you do, they'll be seeing him everywhere, on every street corner in every house. Just tell your men to shut their mouths and open their eyes.
I'll check back in an hour. Brackett turns, walks out of the bedroom. For a moment, Loomis stares at the rain gutter and the broken window as we end scene. It was good, Derek.
Thank you.
Flick number 2, watch this, here with you till 7 p.m.
WMFO Medford. Someday a friend may offer you a chance to visit the other side of a dream. Your ticket is a little packet of white powder called heroin. But every packet of heroin is different. You don't know what's getting into you. Some doses are so strong they kill. Heroin is so vicious that the criminals who make the big money in heroin don't use it. They know a lot of reasons why heroin is very, very dumb. Maybe that's why they call it dope. George Romero brought us Night of the Living Dead.
it became the classic horror film of its time.
Not that room! Not that room!
Now, George Romero brings us the most intensely shocking motion picture experience for all times.
It gets up and kills. The people it kills get up and kill. This situation must be controlled before it's too late. They are multiplying too rapidly.
Dawn of the Dead.
Meet me on the roof at 9 o'clock. Get out.
I don't believe
it.
We're
going to get out in the chopper. We've got to survive. Somebody's got to survive.
They kill for one reason. They kill for food. They eat their victims.
Imagine, if you will, that something has gone terribly wrong.
Shoot it, man.
Now, accept the fact that there's no escaping the horrible consequences. George Romero brings back the dead. Night of the Living Dead has ended. Dawn of the Dead is here.
We must not be lulled by the concept that these are our family members or our friends. They are not. They will not respond to such emotions.
Operator dead. Post abandoned. We may never get out of line.
It's everywhere.
What the hell is it?
Looks like a shopping center, one of those big indoor malls.
What are they doing? Why do they come here?
Some kind of instinct, memory, what they used to do. This was an important place in their lives.
We've got a war.
I'm afraid.
We have spawned our own savagery. Soon, it will consume us all. It is a horrible, hauntingly accurate vision of the mindless excesses of a society gone mad.
They must be destroyed on sight.
When there is no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth.
We are down to the line, folks. We are down to the line.
Dawn of the Dead.